This is Fresh Air. For those of us drawn to tales of madness, violence, and perversity, there's a substantial tradition of Gothic fiction. Poe, Kafka, and Mary Shelley all employed some of the imagery and melodrama of the Gothic form. Patrick McGraw is a writer who's updated the genre. He's the author of a collection of short stories, Blood and Waters and Other Tales, and the novels The Grotesque, Spider, and Dr. Haggard's Disease. Terry Gross talked with McGraw in 1990 around the publication of Spider. McGraw explained how his writing had moved away from the bizarre and supernatural towards the psychological.
Spider is very much a portrait of a schizophrenic, and whatever elements of the macabre, the perverse, the grotesque that are contained within that book are very much a function of a psychotic mind breaking down rather than, in any sense, pieces of gratuitous horror for their own sake.
Let me ask you for your comparison of Gothic versus New Gothic fiction.
I think the traditional Gothic did lay a lot of stress on the furniture, on the dripping caves and the mouldering mansions on the top of hills and dark forests. There's a great stress on the props and the sets. We no longer need those props and sets in order to depict the sorts of characters that inhabited those sorts of locations, and now we can simply depict the mind itself, and it doesn't have to be accompanied by clanking chains and gloomy fortresses and so on. So I think the Gothic is now much more exclusively a psychological condition.
You joined us a couple of years ago on Fresh Air when your collection of short stories was published, and our listeners might remember that you grew up near the gate of an institution for the criminally insane in London, and your father was the medical superintendent there. How does that figure specifically into your new novel, Spider?
As a result of growing up the son of my father, I was equipped with a fairly thorough grounding in mental illness as a small boy. I later worked in his hospital and in another hospital in Canada, and so I got to know at first hand what schizophrenia looks like and other forms of mental illness. When I came to write fiction, I found that this formed a sort of a reservoir of knowledge that I more and more have been able to draw on, which has culminated in this latest novel, which is really centrally a depiction of schizophrenia from a first-hand account of schizophrenia.
I believe your father is retired, but did you show him the manuscript, and did he give you any advice?
Yeah, I would show him the manuscript in various early drafts, and he was very quick to tell me what was plausible and what was not in what I was depicting as a schizophrenic condition. In fact, when I wanted to actually have a relatively a gentle ending to the novel, he told me that this, in fact, was not plausible, that the schizophrenic's fate is generally a rather grim one. So he did push me in the direction of not shying away from the full sort of ghastly horror that schizophrenia is.
What are the considerations when you're writing a book and the narrator is mentally unbalanced, like in your book?
This was the great technical challenge here, was to contain the incoherence and the wildness of madness within the order and the continuity that the novel form demands. And I don't know if I can quite put my finger on how I solved that problem, but a lot of it has to do with, I think, using different time frames. And Spider is always in... he is referring back to his childhood, he's referring to the present, and he's also referring to his period in mental hospital. So there's three times that are occurring simultaneously within the novel, and I found that if I moved between these three times, I could when Spider began to sort of drift off into the more wild areas of his illness, I could bring us back by moving to a different, you know, he would perhaps begin to talk about the present and what he was experiencing in the present as a way of reining us in and giving us once more the sense of where the narrative's going.
When a narrator is schizophrenic, like the character who narrates your novel, the reader really doesn't know how much to trust him.
No, not at all. So the reader has to almost read a second text beyond the one that's in front of him. You have to, in some way, second-guess Spider and understand by what principle he is constantly distorting what it is that he's reporting to you. And once you catch that principle, then you can begin to really interpret what he's telling. You say, no, I know this is not true, but I understand that when he says this, what he means is this, because I've begun to see, you know, the ways in which he contradicts himself and the sorts of anomalies there are in his account.
Writer Patrick McGraw speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Coming up, a reading from McGraw after this short break. This is Fresh Air. And now Patrick McGraw reads us an excerpt from his novel, Spider.
Our narrator in this passage is a strange, sad, solitary figure called Spider. Now, after an absence of 20 years, Spider returns to the slums of the East End of London, where he grew up, and moves into a seedy boarding house run by the indomitable Mrs. Wilkinson. In this passage, he'll recall memories of his father, Horace, a plumber, and of his long-suffering mother. I haven't even told you my name yet. It's Dennis, but my mother always called me Spider. I am a baggy, threadbare sort of a customer, really. My clothes have always seemed to flap about me like sailcloth, like sheets and shrouds. I catch a glimpse of them sometimes as I hobble through these empty streets, and they always look vacant, untenanted, the way the flannel flaps and hollows about me, as though I were nothing, and the clothes were clinging merely to an idea of a man, the man himself being elsewhere, naked. These feelings disappear when I reach my bench, for there I am anchored. I have a wall behind me and water in front of me, and as long as I don't look at the gasworks, all is well. But I had a bit of a shock yesterday, for I discovered that nothing fit me any more. I noticed it first when I got up from the bench. My trousers barely reached the tops of my ankles, and from the ends of my sleeves, my wrists were poking out to an absurd length, like sticks, before flowering suddenly into these long, floppy hands of mine. When I arrived back at the house, everything seemed to have returned to normal, and it occurred to me that the problem might be with my body rather than my clothes. Of course, I wouldn't think of speaking to Mrs. Wilkinson about any of this. She has already made her views clear on the subject. She has forbidden me to wear more than one of any article of clothing at any one time, no more than one pair of trousers, one shirt, one jersey, and so on, though naturally I defy her on this, as I like to wear as many of my clothes as I can. I find it reassuring, and since returning from Canada, reassurance is something I'm simply not getting enough of. Probably the whole thing was just some sort of perceptual error. I have occasionally been troubled this way in the past. I'm a much taller man than my father was, but in other respects I resemble him. He was wiry and short-sighted. He wore round, horn-rimmed spectacles that made him appear owlish. His eyes had a deceptively mild, watery sort of look to them, and when he took his spectacles off, you realised what a startlingly pale blue colour they were. But I've seen those eyes of his fire up with anger, and when that happened, there was nothing mild and watery about him at all, and as often as not, I'd be taken down the coal cellar and feel the back of his belt. Not that he'd let anyone else ever see his anger, he was much too careful for that. But my mother and myself, we saw it. He had no other outlet for it. We were the only people in the world weaker than he was. I remember my mother used to say, "Run down the dog, Spider, and tell your father his supper's on the table." And that's when I knew I'd see that furious pale light come up. The dog was the pub on the corner of Kitchener Street, the Dog and Beggar. It was not a big pub. There were four rooms, the public bar, the saloon bar, and two small snugs where private conversation could be had, each room separated from the others by a wooden screen inset with panels of frosted glass. My father drank in the public bar, and I can still recall pushing open the door and being immediately assailed by a welter of sounds and smells. Men's talk, their barks of laughter, thick smoke, beer, sawdust on the bare boards, and in the winter, a small coal fire burning in the grate. Above the mantelpiece, I remember, was a mirror with a black toucan on it, and the words, "Guinness is good for you." I couldn't read the first word. I only knew that something was good for you. There wasn't anything good for me in the public bar of the Dog and Beggar. I'd see him at the bar, his back bent, leaning with his elbows on the counter and one boot up on the brass rail that ran the length of it at ankle height. Someone would say, "Here's Horace's boy," or "Here's your boy, Horace," and I'd see him turn toward me, a cigarette hanging from his lips, and in his eyes there'd be only that cold loathing that came of being reminded again of the fact of his family and the house to which he must return from the careless sanctuary of the public bar. I'd blurt out my message, my little voice piping like a tin whistle among those shuffling, grunting men, those cattle at their beer. And he would tell me to go on back to the house. He'd be along shortly. No one would know, only I, how intense, how venomous was the hatred he felt toward me at that moment, and I'd hurry away as quick as I could. I was never able to tell my mother how much I disliked going into the Dog and delivering her message, for my father disguised his feelings so effectively, she would have laughed to hear me explain what was really going on. When he was in this frame of mind, and drinking only made things worse, drinking broke down his reserve, mealtimes were hell. I would sit at the kitchen table, gazing at the ceiling, where an unshaded bulb dangled on the end of a braided brown cord. I tended always to slip into reverie in that poky little kitchen, with its clanging pots and dripping tap and ever-present smell of boiling cabbage. It made those ghastly meals tolerable. Outside, the twilight darkened into night, and from over by the railway embankment came the scream of a whistle as some suburban train went steaming by. My mother put in front of me a plate of boiled potatoes, boiled cabbage, and stewed neck of mutton, the meat coming away from the bone in stringy greyish patches. There was a terrible tension in the room as I picked up my knife and fork. I knew my father was watching me. And this made things worse, for I was a clumsy boy at the best of times, only poorly in control of those long, gangling limbs of mine. I stuffed a large lump of potato in my mouth, but it was too hot, so I had to cough it back onto my plate. "For Christ's sake," he hissed between clenched teeth. My mother glanced at him, her own fork poised over a potato that sat like a plug in a greasy puddle of thin gravy. "Don't lose your temper," she murmured. "It's not the boy's fault." The meal progressed in painful silence. There were no further train noises from over by the railway embankment, nor was there anything moving on Kitchener Street. Cutlery clattered on cheap china as we ate our neck of mutton, and the tap dripped into the sink with a steady plop, plop, plop. The bulb overhead continued to spread a sickly yellow light over the room, and having devoured my food, I sat once more gazing at the ceiling with my lips faintly moving, pausing only to pick at a shred of mutton caught between my teeth. "Put the kettle on then, Spider," said my mother, and I rose to my feet. As I did so, I banged one of my kneecaps against the side of the table, jarring it violently, such that my father's plate moved several inches to the left. I felt him stiffen then. I felt his grip tighten on his fork, onto the end of which he had just scraped a soggy pile of pale, limp cabbage. But mercifully, he said nothing. I lit the gas. At last he finished eating, laid his knife and fork across the middle of his plate, placed his hands on the edge of the table, elbows arched outward at a sharp angle, and prepared to get up from the table. "Off down the pub, I suppose," said my mother, still at work on her last potato, which she had cut into a number of very small pieces, and without lifting her eyes to my father's face. I cast a quick, fearful glance at him, and in the way his jaw worked, I knew what he thought of the pair of us, his gangling, useless son and his mutely reproachful wife, who sat there making little pokes and stabs at her potato and refusing to meet his eye. He took his cap and jacket from the hook on the back of the door and went out without a word. The kettle came to the boil. "Make us a nice cup of tea, then, Spider," said my mother, rising from her chair and brushing at her cheek as she began to gather the dirty plates.
That was Patrick McGraw reading an excerpt from his novel Spider. His latest book is called Dr. Haggard's Disease. This is Fresh Air.